Welcome to Season 9, Episode 2 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we decide to pass some encrypted messages about talking about spy games. We also talk a little bit about sports and gaming from a variety of angles. And no, that was not a mistake. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 2 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me is Chris and Paul. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Ah, well, it's been 2 weeks. It's weird.
It is.
Yeah, well, it's even weirder for me, as you guys know, but it's actually for our listeners. I'm currently been laid off, so I'm in the unemployment, so to speak, but don't worry, I'm actually getting a lot of interest, and they're paying me a severance, so hey, I can't complain there. But it is a little boring. You know, it's like, okay.
Gives you more time to look up RPG stuff on the internet.
You know what? Just like job searching, you can only do that so much. I'm sorry. I'm here to tell you. Otherwise, it's just the same stuff over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. That said, why don't we get into some news? And so we can kickstart all this stuff. That was a bad pun. Unintentional. First up, it's actually not a Kickstarter. This is one that I saw and people seem to be making a fuss over. And personally, I don't give a shit. If that makes any sense. WotC, the 2017 conventions calendar, they're not on the Gen Con schedule. They have HasCon, but no Gen Con. I don't think that means that they're not going to be there, really, but it means that they're not, like, sponsoring it or anything. They said there's... Last year, the company is skipping... I don't know. It says that they're skipping it, so I don't know. But they're going to, I guess, PAX South, Winter Fantasy, PAX East in March, GaryCon, Origins, PAX West, HasCon, and GameholdCon. But apparently, no GenCon.
That's odd.
You know, it is not odd when you consider the fact that GenCon is no longer really associated with WotC.
That's true. I mean, I get that. Yeah, it's a weird thing to see something that grew from directly from D&D now be... You know, now have its parents like completely separated from it.
But it's been like that for a long time, to be honest with you. And I mean,
since they released control of it.
I mean, in some ways, several of the conventions I went to were more a Paizo event than a WotC event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this does not surprise me. That, you know, and again, for any company, they have to make choices of what conventions they're going to go to, and they've decided that this fits their whatever their schedule is better.
Yeah, and I don't think they have a very large staff anymore either, so no. I'm sure that they've cut back on a lot of that stuff.
No, when what was it? When the hell did the Tyranny of Dragons crap come out? Was that the early 5th edition?
Yep, that was early 5th.
Yeah.
That was literally the first thing.
Yeah. And no offense, that was a really big so-called event at Gen Con, and it was lame. To be honest with you, that was my overall impression of everything they were doing at that Gen Con. So, to those who, you know, the only thing people are bitching about is, I guess, this is obviously Gen Con 50.
Oh.
Right? 40, 50?
Wow. Okay, so that's still kind of an odd thing to do then. Yeah, so 50 would probably be pretty close, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. So, yeah, it's I think it is. 30. It's either 40 or 50. I forget.
Yeah.
I think it is 50. I don't want to do the math. Let me actually go to the Gen Con site, because it will say. But I know...
They reduced their presence on a lot of this stuff, and it's... it's kind of interesting 50. That they're going to GaryCon and GameholeCon.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they're using more local people on the ground there than sending actual staff from Washington. I don't know. Are they based out of Washington now? I think they are.
I have no idea. You know, I don't think that matters almost. But yeah, Gen Con is number 50. So this is the 50th year. And so people are going like, well, why wouldn't you show up for the 50th year? Because I get news for you. WotC, who owns them? Hasbro. Hasbro doesn't give a shit.
Right. That's true.
You know, so this doesn't surprise me. It really doesn't. And I honestly, I kind of don't care. I know that sounds horrible.
Well, the thing is, it would be one thing if it was their legacy.
Right.
You know, this was still TSR 50 years later. You're darn right.
Sure. They'd be quick to the right. Moon. But it's not.
If Gary was still around or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, but because it's two sections removed, first by WotC, and then basically when they got merged with Hasbro, it's such then, a small distance comparison.
And then, of course, Gen Con got sold.
Yeah.
And again, the whole management isn't. I mean, that's it. If it was still being run wholly by some sort of subsidiary of TSR or WotC, it'd be a different story. But neither one of those is true. And the company itself is, like you said, two steps removed. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is something I've said before. Hasbro really doesn't know what to do with Dungeons & Dragons. Never has.
No. The only reason they picked it up in the first place is because it came with Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
And they've been trying to figure out how to make it a brand ever since.
Yeah. And everything that they did is horrible. And actually, even before that, everything that's been done with Dungeons & Dragons has been horrible.
TSR's history is a long and twisted story.
What was that?
Well, the original TSR is such a weird and twisted story that WotC was actually a step up.
I'm not arguing that, but I'm just arguing, like, you know, things like when you talk about making it a brand, you know, Dungeons & Dragons a brand.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we need to have Dungeons & Dragons, I don't know, underwear. What? It's like, what was it? Was it like shoes or something that they did like 1 year in conjunction with some shoe manufacturer? And just like, really? No. It's like this weird, it's like the cash. I kind of hate when people say, we need to make it a brand. It's like, it's not a brand. It's a thing. It's a game. It's not really a brand. It's not something you can do something like that. I know people will argue, well, they could. There's all this wonderful material. There's a bunch of source material. Yes, you know, people argue that, you know, obviously the D&D movies have not done well, and there's a lot of things that they could mine for a decent Dungeons & Dragons movie. And it's like, it's never going to fucking happen. And I know I'm saying the F word a lot in here, but...
what's going to happen? It'll happen. Whether or not it's good or not remains to be seen.
No, I just know that realistically with... Yeah, I don't ever see it. And it's like, even if it was halfway decent, at this point, it's like, why? You've actually kind of lost that boat. I'd rather I would rather see more original material, fantasy in terms of movies, whatever, TV shows, than something that's D&D inspired.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like junk, we're becoming after the fact.
Yeah.
Well, it also has a lot of baggage too.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, all your fans know how a magic missile should work and how a fireball should work and how a lightning bolt should work and, you know, what rangers can and can't do. And as soon as they go off script with that in a TV show or movie, all the fans are like, well, you can't do that.
Right. So.
And it's.
So it's kind of bad. All right. So we're going to continue on this con talk just a little bit because there's two conventions I want to mention that are both Kickstarters. First up is Wagon Con. Which is in, where the hell is this? I forget.
Columbia Gorge. It's Oregon.
Yep, Oregon. That's why. So they've actually reached their goal. But if you happen to be in Oregon, and this is actually pretty soon. This is May 5th, 6th, and 7th.
Wow. Yeah. It's so, right around the world to be speaking.
They've actually already reached the goal. They're only asking for $1,000. But.
Pretty good. Sounds like they had 100 people so far. I'm hoping to. Add another 50 to 100 people. So I think it's smart to not run this out too long before the actual convention.
Right.
People get jazzed up, get their money out there, and then in like 2 or 3 short months, it's time to go to the convention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So next up is one that's actually in my neck of the woods, which is, earlier I was talking about MaricopaCon. Well, this is actually another one that's in Phoenix, and I'm like, I'd never heard of it. Actually, it was started last year, and this is its second year. It's called Crit Hit. It's July 15th and 16th. They're working towards their goal. They still got 42 days. And, of course, some of the people that are involved are the guys from Savage Worlds. Sean Hensley and Sean Patrick Fannin. And what was that?
Well, that'd be worth the price of admission right there if you want to meet them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I think they're down in Tucson, if memory serves me. I think that is correct. I could be wrong. I know one of them is. So, and it's, they talk about board games, you know, because they want to, I think they're going to, it's going to have a lot more board games. I mean, there's obviously going to be an RPG component, but there's going to be board games, which actually, board games and the miniatures actually at Gen Con was more exciting than anything else at the convention that I did. I hate to say it. And some of it was just in the miniature area. It's really interesting because there's a lot of visual stuff to look at. I mean, it's amazing some of the stuff those people build. And you're just like, how much time did you take? You know, and that's at least something you can talk to somebody about. Whereas, just honestly, some of the RPGs, I don't really want to hear about your character. You know, and I mean that with all due respect and love, but nobody cares. I really, it brings back bad memories for me when people do that. It's like they have this love relationship with their character, and you're just like, dude, I think I'm going to take 5 steps back. And I mean, I don't mean that badly, but it just seems, I don't know, maybe I love to play games, but I don't get myself that emotionally attached to my characters. At Gen Con, one of my favorite seminars were all the writing seminars. I'm not a writer. I'm never going to be a writer. But I find them interesting because they give you interesting insight into the difference between writing a story and doing an RPG story, because they're two different things. Mm-hmm. Vastly different. And one of them, you know, these people are like, I'm taking this seminar. You know, they ask questions like, well, I have all this campaign history I want to write up. Well, just write it up. No one's going to read it. You're not going to publish it and make it the next, you know, I don't know, freaking Harry Potter series, you know. It's not going to happen. I mean, I don't mean that to be bad, but it's just like, what's interesting to you and your group, everyone else doesn't care about. It really is that simple. I mean, the only times that that's ever worked is with a lot of heavy editing and omission and changes.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that comes to mind is the Dragonlance books, because some of that material originated from actual campaign sessions that they were doing. But the books aren't the campaign sessions. There were events that came from the campaign setting that got put into the book, but they're not the same thing. It's not like...
Well, that's a gamer tradition. You build your characters, you run them through the adventure, and then you become the big wigs for the next generation of gamers.
Right.
Yep. Like, Circle of Eight is literally Gary's gaming group. In fact, I think there's this gamer on RPG.net who literally, I think, is handles Little Geezer, who was one of the eight. You know, so it's kind of weird just seeing that little bit of history here. Or say nothing of Kevin Symbiote as the Defilers for the Plutonium Fantasy role-playing game, where they're this big, epic group. But the thing is, you got to be careful when you're basically staring at your own navel that people actually care.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that.
So, talk about caring about something really deeply. I always love this the people that do these weird Kickstarters. And this is handcrafted props for the London and Cairo chapters of the Call of Cthulhu campaign by Chaosium, the Mask of Nyarlathotep. I can't even pronounce it.
Nyarlathotep.
Okay, thank you. I'm really horrible at that pronunciation. And I am always amazed at some of the crap that these guys, people produce. And he always seems to get funded.
Yeah, and this one's funded well. It's got, over $3,000 extra over its 100% funding. It's crazy.
So, I mean, you just look at this stuff, and it's just like, you know, some of the example stuff, and it's like, that is insane. You know? So, I mean, I'm always really impressed by these things. And these are these are the weird things that, honestly, sometimes I don't think people even buy these to play with. They just buy them because they're, what was it?
They're collectibles.
Yeah.
You know, you put them down, you hoard them, you throw them in your back room, and then you forget about them for years on end.
You know, or you just have them around, like when you play certain games, just for mood. You know, like, for example, next time I play Traveler, I'm gonna wear my Traveler shirt that I bought a while back, which was for the Duke of Regina's Lift Cavalry. What the hell?
Wow, it's that is not a cheap Kickstarter either. If you want to get the full load of stuff, looks like it's going to cost you somewhere on the order of about almost $800.
Yeah. Wow. Still, fun stuff. All right, so we get into some interesting stuff now. Like, this is one that I thought was kind of weird. and it's actually been funded. Elite Dangerous Role-Playing Game. It's based on the Elite video game. I don't know if any of you guys ever played the old Elite game.
I remember it. I don't know how many times I actually played it, though.
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, you know, had this whole trade, early, trade component, which was popular, which honestly felt very Traveler-esque to me, you know. And the early, you know, had this line drawn, and when you had to dock with the damn space station, you had to match the rotation of the space station with your spacecraft, and which made docking really hard. And it had, you know, it basically was reminiscent of, it actually was inspired by, obviously, to the 2001 scene, you know, where the little craft is actually trying to dock with the space station, and it's matching the rotation of the spinning station. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's got a real 70s space feel, which I kind of like.
Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how well it actually translates into an actual RPG. So, but it's funded. I mean, they were asking a good amount. They were asking about
$55,000.
Almost $56,000. They got about 62 plus, 720 backers, and there's still 22 days left to go at the time that we record this.
Yeah, they blew through that one.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So
never made the power of nostalgia.
Well, I just think it's kind of cool. So.
Oh, yeah. No, it looks awesome, man. I'm just, this is totally new territory for me. I don't think I ever remembered them back when I was a kid.
Yeah. So, all right, let's get to, this is kind of an interesting one. The Age of Anarchy RPG, a patron-based role-playing game set in Norman, England during the time of Civil War.
I'm tempted by this one.
Yeah, this one's kind of interesting. Just from, I love the whole, you have patrons, and whatever your patrons' goals are, that's kind of how your adventure goes. And in many ways, I mean, I could see an offshoot of this being almost Three Musketeers-ish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't. That's just me.
Yeah, what it reminds me of is Blackadder the First. Kind of the idea, you got all the different kings around, the different toadies, and not very friendly people, despite being running around with swords and stuff. Kind of a proto Game of Thrones in a lot of ways. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's where they got their inspiration for it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, this is it's an interesting period of time in which to set it, because it's kind of one that doesn't normally fall into the scope of people's, you know, collective. It's kind of that generic medieval time, but they've got a very specific setting for it during the.
Yeah. Civil War.
One of the first English Civil Wars, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, they still got 20 days to go, and they're only asking $3,400, and they got like 22 plus. So
yeah, they're most likely gonna get there as long as people are interested in the sucker. Plus, you know, that time of history is interesting, because if they do it right, they can do it literally as the William the Conqueror bloodline died, basically two generations in due to accidents and misfortunes. And that literally would probably be one of the best times to play this sort of game in there, because who's going to get the crown?
Right.
You get to find out who.
Yep.
All right, next up we have Pathogen Unclassified, a role-playing game. So, apocalyptic horror, survival horror, set 3 years after a global parasitic outbreak. And everyone plays survivors. So it's like, okay, well, that's interesting. That could go several ways. This could be everything from, don't know.
Looks like an RPG version of 40 Days Later.
Yeah, or, you know, I mean, you could obviously play any of the weird zombie movies.
Yeah. I'm looking at trying to see their system. They seem to have kind of a proprietary system for it. So
yeah,
I did notice that they were running this on the back of a previously funded game called Spy, which I'm unfamiliar with, which I might have to look into, but they mentioned that earlier top, but this also reminds me of All Flesh Must Be Eaten. That's the immediate vibe I get off of it.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, I always just like to bring these up, because I mean, their goal, only $2,000, not that bad.
Yeah.
Let's see,
they're almost about two-thirds of the way there, but they got 23 days to go.
And $7 is for the PDF. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, hey, you know, if you want another PDF game, you know, game PDF for your collection, $7, that's not too bad.
No, it's not that, at all.
That's always what I look at with a lot of these Kickstarters. Like, is there a cheap option? Just say, you know, I'm not really interested maybe in a print product, although if I find I really like the game, I may kick myself later for it. Is there a cheap option? And, you know, $7 for a PDF, you know, that's lunch. Or not even, depending.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, I kind of like the premise here, although I think it's, I'm going to be making fun of the premise here because they're blaming GMOs for the outbreak.
Mm. Yeah, sure, why not?
That's gotta love it. So Frankenfood made Frankenstein's. You gotta love it.
And you never know. Who knows? Okay. All right. We have this one I thought was kind of interesting. Make 100 Chronicles RPG Kit. It says, old school bundle of four booklets, Almanac, Imaginarium, Session Planner, and Game Diary. For use with any system, and I'm all about things that are any system, you know. So basically, book one is a fantasy calendar. Book two is just an idea log for, you know, dungeons, encounter sheets, adventure design tools. Session planner is just some tools to help you plan and track sessions, and then game diary is player tools for adventure notes.
That so, sounds fun. Yeah, it reminds me of the old first edition GM's tools from the AD&D era, only more system generic. So, yeah, I like that.
They blew through their goal, too.
Yeah. Right. The only thing I've noticed is that it doesn't look like you can actually back it anymore, can you? I just noticed that.
No, you can't.
That's a shame.
It's not tended to go, but...
Yeah.
That's really weird.
I would think that they would at least have made the PDFs available.
That's the reward that is completely out is just one physical
set of four books and then digital PDF copies. I'm a little that's weird. I would have thought, unless they just capped it at 100.
Well, they're probably using this for testing more than anything else. You know, like, as much as it sucks, if they actually sell their stuff and they actually make money off this sucker. If it does work well, they're probably going to run it again in a year with larger economies of scale or something. Yeah. This is just a test. You know, it feels like a test Kickstarter just to see, can we do it?
Yeah, but I mean, that is just weird that they... Yeah, and it's like you can only read the comments if you're a backer. Well, what are you going to do, back it for $10 to read? That's weird.
They say, note that we are limiting our pledge level to 100 backers in the second half of this year. If this current Kickstarter is successful, we plan to do a second set of volumes, which will allow our customers to continue to use these tools for their ongoing campaigns. Hmm. So, they specifically did it so that only 100 people could back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's one way to, you know, and people backed a lot of money. I mean, you sit down and think about it.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess because I mean, that makes sense. So some people backed over $40 or something, because if you look at it, you know, at $40 by 100 backers, that'd be $4,000.
Yep.
So interesting. That is very interesting. I guess that's what the Make 100 thing was about. Too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're going to look forward to what they're going to do in the future, because obviously I think this has been, I would consider this a success.
Oh yeah,
definitely. So.
All right, this is another Kickstarter that apparently I saw someone post something about, which was, Alas for the Awful Sea, Myth, Mystery, and Crime in the 1800s UK. A tabletop RPG about politics, folklore, and the human heart set in rural 19th century town desperate to survive. Almost sounds Cthulian.
Yeah, and also a potato famine from Ireland.
Yeah,
kind of a Dickensian mix of Moby Dick and Cthulhu, with maybe a little bit of Charles. Who did the monster style art? What was his name? Charles Gorry.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah, that's what it kind of reminded me of when I looked at it. I mean, it looks really, really interesting. I don't know if. I think this is one of those buy-in games where not only does the GM have to be enthusiastic about running it, but all the players have to be on the same page and ready to kind of dive into the setting, as it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so they're asking about $11 US for the PDF, and then if you want the soft cover, it's about $20.
they've already made their goal well past it. So
yeah. I wanted like 801, so but they got to, like a month ago. I think it's safe to assume if you want it, you can come in.
Yeah. So just thought that was interesting. Here's another one that's actually fully funded, was the Midgard campaign setting, Dark Roads and Deep Magic. And they were asking for $20,000, they were at $43,400 at the time of this writing. So, that is actually, and it's like $19 for the Heroes Handbook PDF.
Yeah. Wow.
And then, it's weird, I don't, but that's just, it's weird, because then it's like, the player's guide is $19. The campaign PDF is $25. So I don't understand. I'd have to actually. I'm not quite sure what the difference between the Hero's Handbook, the player's guide, and the campaigns. All right, different. Yeah. All right. So the handbook details the races, variants, archetypes, and backgrounds. The player's guide collects all the racial lore, class options, feats, and equipment. And then I guess the campaign setting is the is a 300 plus page volume describing the Midgard regions. So if you need, if you wanted it all, I guess.
Looks like it's $95, I think. Well,
okay.
I think you can do it for 80 for just the basic books, which is the PDF and the hardcovers of the setting and the handbook. You can do that for $80.
And for $65, you can just do everything digitally.
Right.
That's a lot of material, but yeah. I'm just trying to make sure that I didn't pick up anything that I already own. And some of this looks very familiar, but I'm assuming they did a remake here.
Yeah, they're saying that it's all set 5 years later, and they decided to update. Add Deep Magic. I don't know what Deep Magic means.
Oh, Deep Magic is there's essentially Book of Magic.
Okay.
It's this. It's a knuckle dragger of a book. At least the original one was for Pathfinder. In many, it was bigger than a Midgard book, and it was essentially here's all these crazy magic systems we thought of over the years, and what you can do with them. And it has like a spell list that's book of any of the third edition to shame.
Interesting. Okay.
So there you go. There's that. And so now we come up to two different Game Master screens that came up. First one I actually posted about before, which was the Dice Base Master RPG Dungeon Tablescope screen. These look really nice, and it's interesting they have like some sort of like, are they magnetic balls for hinges that you can use to set them? So you can actually, so each of the what I'm going to call pages, they're all made out of wood. Mm-hmm. Each of the little sides, you can actually kind of custom put them together the way you want to arrange them, which is kind of cool. The bad news is it's expensive.
Yeah.
It's like $100. You know, and that's just for like a couple of, that's like the basic panels, and it goes up from there.
Mm-hmm.
They're nice looking. I have to admit, I whoever did this put a lot of design effort into this, and probably a lot of prototypes.
Yeah, you can see it because some of the designs, like you're looking down, you're noticing that they have segregated dice sections on some of them.
Right.
Or the make marbles or how they fold together and all that.
Yeah. I mean it's really nice. I'm very impressed.
You know, it's like looking at the Sultan from like the table things here.
Oh, she
looks awesome until you look at the price.
Yeah. What is that? Geek Chic?
Yeah, Geek Chic. That's it. Yeah. Where you look at it and you're going, oh my god, I want this. And then you see the price and then you run away screaming.
Oh, I know. And it's fun when you... they've been at Gen Con once or twice, if memory serves me. And it's like, you're just like, Jesus, these tables are nice. But no, this is that table's worth more than my car.
Yep.
Maybe when I win the lottery.
Yeah, even then, no.
Well, I mean, if you're looking for an heirloom-style piece of furniture... And that's what they build them at. You know, they kind of advertise them as. Is this is something you will literally pass down to your progeny? That, I mean, that makes sense. But, you know, that's still that.
You just hope your progenies are gamers as well.
That's gonna be the big thing because probably I know they might sell it to grad sale for like $10, and that would break your heart and your wallet.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's actually funner to actually see the ultimate gaming tables that other people have built themselves.
Yeah. There's some pretty impressive ones out there. Yeah.
I remember one time I actually thought about building something myself, and, you know, I had some interesting thoughts about what I wanted to do, and I'm just like, never transpired. A, didn't have the money for it, and then B, some of the stuff I thought about nowadays makes no sense.
Yeah, it just changed so dramatically at this point.
Oh, well, I know. I mean, well, you know, because I thought it would be interesting to integrate more tech into the table, I always thought, in some way.
Oh, okay.
And it's just like all that technology has just changed so much, and just like, nope, I'm not going to do it. No sense in it. Makes no sense. Let's just screw it. You know, I remember having an actual dumb terminal.
Oh.
No, because I actually thought it'd be cool to actually have like little text-based dumb terminals, because I was thinking I was going to make it a Traveler-esque kind of gaming table.
Oh.
And, you know, let's face it, Traveler is nothing but kind of really like high-tech and low-tech at the same time. You know, has that, especially the computers are very like, you know, 1950s inspired with the tech terminals.
Yep.
In a way. And I thought, oh, that'd be very cool to just kind of have like this, you know, basically use really generic web pages, but behind the scenes, but, you know, forced to have like an interactive system that they could, you know, you could type in. And so I was thinking, okay, if I design the table a certain way, I could just have like two people can share one dumb terminal or something, you know, or something along those lines. And I was like, that'd be kind of cool. But I decided, no, that'd just be too waste. You know, that'd be a waste of time and money and other things. But having the dumb terminal was cool just to learn about. So anyway, the other table screen was the Deluxe Dungeon Master screen with dice tray. This guy is only asking for $6,000. And it's basically some wood dice screens. And
he's not going to make it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think if you're going to spend any real money, I mean, because the wooden screen with dice tray is $75. So, I mean, for $25 more, you can have a really decent one. So, no, I don't think he's going to make it, but I throw that out there. You never know. He still has 20-something, 9 days to go.
I mean, I think his design is, I mean, you can almost see his entire design there. You could practically do this yourself.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only bad news. The other one, you definitely could not do. I mean,
that would be a lot
this
more.
This is, I mean, his prototype here is just some hinges. I mean, some wood and some hinges. I could probably, even with my horrible skill, I could probably build this.
Yeah. No, I think it's actually a really nice little design. The problem is, you're right, it's relatively easy to make.
He would have done much better if there was something a little complicated about it and he was just able to sell the plans.
Yeah.
So. Yep.
Food for thoughts.
All right. Last up is the Dark Obelisk Extended Pre-Generated PCs for a Pathfinder RPG. Just what we needed, right?
Lots and lots of characters.
Yeah.
Well, you can tell them all about them.
What was that?
That way you can tell them all about them.
Yeah.
Tell
me about
them. Yeah, this is a lot of characters.
So about $10 for the PDF, I guess, version.
You know. If you're a Pathfinder fan and you need a lot of characters, this is your project. It's as simple as that.
True.
Well,
they only have $750 goal, so it'll probably hit it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a book of pre-generated characters, though they are intended to be used as PC starting points for new players to dive right into a game system and be easily dropped into the game as NPCs by the GM. So basically, it's a whole bunch of pre-gens so that new players don't have to build their characters. Okay. Which I get. You know, I really do.
Well, it's a lot easier for pre-builds here because, you know, Pathfinder might take a long time to build your character, ultimately.
Well, not only that. I mean, I just think about people who have never played games before. And let's just say for some reason you are introducing them with something like Pathfinder, which I personally would consider a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say you are. I mean, hell, I know some people that played early D&D and probably shouldn't have. Because even that was...
Well, you want to start them out on Champions, I would think.
Yeah. Make sure they get their engineering degree.
Actually, some people I know would understand Champions better than D&D, but that's another story. So, you know, no, it's interesting. I don't think I'll be kickstarting it myself. But it is out there. So, That's it for the Kickstarters, unless there was something I missed. Was there anything I missed that you guys knew about?
I don't think so.
Nothing comes to mind.
All right, well, why don't we jump into the first topic, which is, of course, spies and gaming spies and all of that fun stuff that's in there. And let's try to keep this a little more brief than we possibly could, because there's a lot of material that you've put out here, but we're not going to be able to cover all of that.
Okay, well, let's just start with the basic premise. Ultimately, if you have a game of spying, it's going to be a game of information. And the things you're going to need for your spy game are the ability and need to figure out and keep secrets, where killing isn't the best option, because you can't really have a spy game in an orc hunt, because, you know, hey, look, he knows something, kill him. Okay, solved. And there's also different permutations you can do when it comes to spying, whether or not you go for black and white versus shades of gray, current affairs versus the cinematic flair, whether you're going for high security or high action, whether you're trying to keep your technology relatively reasonable or whether you're going right to the sci-fi closet, how much support are PCs going to have in the field, or what sort of props are you going to need for the actual game itself. And that's just off the top of my head here. Like, I think we talked about something similar when we were talking about computer hacking a while back, so I don't do too many things there. I'll let you.
I just got a recent bundle of the James Bond 007 RPG stuff from back in the 80s from Victory Games.
Cool.
And a lot of them came with mission dossiers, maps, full color maps and stuff like that, and telegrams and messages for the players and things like that. So they were a lot of them aren't cheap to get anymore, at least in physical form, and you can't get them in digital form either, unfortunately, and not legally anyway that I've seen. But they do have a lot of really cool stuff, and even though it's James Bond, if you tweak a couple of things, you know, replace the singular Bondian character with four, you know, mid-level agents, they actually can make decent adventures. You have to tweak them because some of the stuff is just a little silly, but they do actually work out pretty well.
That sounds awesome. And in fact, that's almost a necessity for some spy games, especially when you're doing a tabletop, is to have that feel of the portfolio. Because otherwise you're just playing a game and, you know, you have imaginations, but those little details often cause a game like this just to pop.
Well, you end up with the I'm your director, go out on a mission thing. I think the dossiers might help people to to embrace that feel of like, okay, now we get to make our own decisions about the information, as opposed to completely relying on whatever the GM says.
Or you could even pull something like out of Mission Impossible and just record like an MP3 file and go, you know, just basically have a file you got to play, you got to listen to it once, and then you're not allowed to hear it again because it's self-destructed.
Yep.
Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I recently watched some Mission Impossible, which is actually a pretty good show, and is probably not a bad format for people who want to run a spy RPG, because there's usually three or four, maybe sometimes five people on a mission. Each of them have distinct and different roles within the mission. And I mean, just a couple episodes I watched had everything from convinced a guy that he had amnesia for 2 years, and they were trying to get information from him by convincing him that he had amnesia and was taken back to his home country and was being imprisoned, to rescues of agents from prison and sending someone into a prison to gain information and then extracting them again. So all these are perfectly good, you know, most of them could be used in some way as an adventure material.
Yeah, I can see that. And that would add a really nice element to the game, ultimately. Just, again, I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up being a media talk as well, because, you know, spy movies come out like a dime a dozen. They range from the absolute serious and kind of boring to the absolute action-packed.
True. But,
to the comedic.
Oh, absolutely.
True, that too, yep.
Yeah, you can't dismiss those. Everything, oh, yeah. Everything from the Casino Royale parody.
Yes.
To the Austin Power movies.
Yep.
And again, Get Smart. Or How Learn to Love the Shoe.
You know, the funny thing about Get Smart is that Don Adams actually said once that, you know, he had that famous tagline, you know, would you believe? And at one point he says he was eventually doing an imitation of someone else doing an imitation of him.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because people would always come up to him and imitate him. And eventually he says, I'm imitating people who have imitated me because I don't remember how to do it myself anymore.
Nice.
And Mel, we've passed to that one.
Yeah, and with Get Smart, I would throw in the Man from U.N.C.L.E., as that's you wouldn't want to use that as a template for your missions because it was pretty silly.
Absolutely. Like, it's basically you're going to have to determine how silly or sane do you want to get your game. And the thing is with spying, you can almost do it in just about any environment because there's always going to be secrets of some sort that you're going to need from others. However, some elements in some worlds make more sense for dealing with tradecraft or spying.
Yep.
And of course, you know, a personal favorite that we talked about in the past, of course, is the Cold War.
Right.
I think it's safe to assume we all agree, hands down, that would probably be the most interesting one because you can't have a hot war because everybody dies.
That, in our minds now, there was true, you know, spy tradecraft there. I mean, either that or right from hell, even all the way back to World War II. Cold War.
There's your hot war scenario.
Right.
Is that during World War II there were spies still running? You can have spies during a hot war.
But my point was is that once you reach like where we're at now, everyone, you know, a most spy game, it's like most people are like, well, that's all in the internet. Well, not really, but okay. But you know, you kind of get that. And I find that, you know, when you watch movies, especially spy movies, you're like, some of this stuff, why would you be doing it that way these days? And you don't know. Sometimes it bends the plausibility.
Between science fantasy and, you know, and
real
just,
life.
You know, and just fiction, yeah. You know, pretty much everything for James Bond is science fantasy. The movies in that respect, not the novels or the newspaper strips, but all the movies are science fantasy.
Yeah.
Not disagreeing on that one, that's for sure.
But no, I mean, so the Cold War, you know, has that really nice, what I call, you know, nice, you know, low-tech feel where there's no hacking, which, I mean, as much as I love computers, that just kind of ruins a lot of things.
Well, it has enough technology that you can do the cool stuff, but not enough that you basically get sidelined by your own equipment.
I think that's what it is. I think that's what ruins it for a lot of RPGs, not just spy games, where the equipment becomes more important than the player characters.
I think if you're going to use something in contemporary times, you need to, as the game master, you really need to figure out why it is. You know, you can't just say, "Oh, your cell phones don't work here," or "Your equipment doesn't work here." If you keep doing that, the players, you know, they're going to feel kind of like, "Well, you know, why bother?" You need to figure out why they would need to retrieve information from a person as opposed to just getting it securely emailed.
Right.
Or, you know, that you know, you need to sit down and think about why you would do it that way.
Well, I mean, you have to take a clue from what I would call criminal investigations. It's like there's a lot of information that you're not going to find on the internet. Now, you may get clues, but you're not going to get it all from whatever. Right. You know, people are always like, well, there's video cameras everywhere. Not really. I got news for you. It doesn't quite work that way, and they don't always work. And, you know, I mean, I've had this conversation with people in, like, science fiction games where they're like, well, shouldn't there be cameras everywhere? I should be able to, you know, you take the Star Trek scenario, and it's like, why the hell wouldn't you know if some, why in Star Trek don't they know that people fucking pass gas or something? You know, it's like.
Exactly.
Well, and I mean that
Lieutenant Miller passed gas at 3 o'clock, which is why he wasn't at his duty station or something like that.
We know that generates a ton of information, and even in the future, you still need to store that information in order for it to be valuable.
Well, you know, I'll give you for instance. I was once told at the place that I worked by someone that there's a program that runs on all the computers that takes snapshots of the screen captures. And they review it to make sure that you're not doing something wrong. And I'm like, that's a lot of data. Who does that? Even a computer can't differentiate enough of that. You would have to have someone monitoring that. And there's no way. Just the storage alone would kill you.
Yeah.
And again, all the data in the world doesn't mean jack if you can't find it quickly.
Or if you can't correlate it. I mean, a single piece of information is no good if you don't have anything to use it with.
Right.
Yeah, so, well, yeah, I mean, those are all ways you can kind of use that. You know, you can do contemporary spy games. You just need to make sure that, you know, you have that set up so that when the players put the pieces together, that it makes sense.
All right. Well, why don't we get off the settings and get to some of the other stuff that you have listed here, because some of it's really interesting. Like, you have listed, obviously, the killing is not the best option, which in most spy games is true. Or, you know, one of the things that I always, you know, it's like, why would you let that guy go? And, you know, for instance, like the bad guys, why would you let the bad guy go? And I remember there's this old movie with Walter Matthau called Hopscotch. You ever see it?
No. Rings a bell, but not recently.
Yeah, he played like a CIA operative or something like that, that basically they kind of let goes, and he's like, he basically quit because they were, you know, basically taking him out of the field. And one of the guys was like, why did you let such and such go? He says, you know, he says, because I know this guy. I know how he operates. I know how he works. If I take him in, capture him, they're just going to replace him with someone we don't know. And it's going to take us years to figure out that guy's problem and figure out how to deal with him. You know,
yep.
He says, it's much better. I'd rather just leave the guy in the field that I know. And, you know, sometimes I win, sometimes he wins. And, you know, he actually considered it really more of a game than anything else. And that was actually an interesting, it was a comedy movie. And the whole premise was eventually he decided to write his memoirs.
And yeah, that's kind of one of the most interesting things is I can imagine how many people, well, one, their secrets die with their grave, but I can imagine a lot of people have their memoirs ready to go when they die, because then you can't do a damn thing against them.
Yeah.
You know, that would actually be a good premise for a campaign. Hey, look, this spy document from this great spy who's been dead for 5 years just came on the market and was bought on eBay.
Right.
And now everybody wants you. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or your memoirs could be really boring.
That is true. You know.
So. But yeah, so what else? So you have, one of the other things you have listed here was black and white versus shades of gray.
Yeah, because let's be honest, James Bond, for everything they may try to put gray in there, it's very black and white.
Especially, yes.
You know, I'm the hero, I'm fighting the villains, these cartoony characters that are often caricatures of themselves. Don't get me wrong, I love Jaws, but he's a caricature.
Mm-hmm. Or Oddjob, or...
Oh, yeah.
Any of the Bond villains, just take your pick.
Yep. The shades of gray is tougher to pull off sometimes. You know, as your players, you know, if they hear spy and they think James Bond, they are going to think in that terms of black and white. So getting that shades of gray, I think it can be a tougher sell.
Yeah.
And maybe starting out with black and white and then moving towards the shades of gray is all, you know, might be something.
That is true.
Oh, you start with a whole bunch of idealistic agents who realize that it's not what they really signed up for.
Exactly.
So, okay, so you have another one that I like, which is current affairs versus cinematic flair. And I would have to say this is always a tough one because you almost want always a mix of the two.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, because it's like, it's great to have current events because then it's like, hey, you know, we live in the real world. And especially if you have it set within, you know, something that's obviously either real world or quasi-real world, you know, it's like, because to me, it's like, for example, if you were playing a spy game in the Marvel universe, that it would be a completely different game than the other Agents real world. What was that?
It'd be Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that'd actually be kind of fun.
Maybe. I'm just saying. So, I mean, and that in itself, you know, but that, is that a spy game or is it just an action game? You could argue either way.
Well, I think with current affairs, though, the nice thing about that is that you can get that shades of gray that we just previously talked about.
Right.
So you're sending players into, say, Syria to retrieve a, you know, a warlord, you know, but by doing that, they're going to destabilize the situation even more. So here you've got them having to decide, you know, should they, you know, they have the opportunity, but maybe their only opportunity is to actually just take him out as opposed to kidnapping. And, you know, so,
well, you know, and then you get into some really interesting things. And when you talk real world, well, you know, I think I've talked about it before where, you know, realistically, when you start moving more into the real world, some of the stuff we do, you know, some of the stuff isn't what we would consider, isn't necessarily like you were talking about, you know, I don't know, capturing a warlord and doing something with them. We did that. It was called, you know, Mogadishu.
Yeah.
Yep, wasn't a great plan. And that wasn't done by, you know, obviously spycraft people. That was actually militaristic. And it's interesting how, you know, many of the things that we talk about, you know, a lot of the traditional roles that we would think spies would do, spies don't do that. Instead, we have a lot of special operations people, at least in the United States, that do that kind of stuff. I'm sure it's very similar in other countries, you know, where they kind of straddle that border between being actual military people and actually being, you know, spies in a way.
Yeah. A lot of them are basic glorified bean counters for all intents and purposes. They sift through data. They probably have a regular 9-to-5 job, and they're looking for these little pieces of data.
Well, I mean, you take any analyst at the CIA, NSA, hell, FBI, you name it. You know, that's all they do. They sit in a cubicle and analyze data. That's their job.
Yep.
So they hit gold.
Yeah.
I think another thing about the cinematic flair thing is, and that kind of leads into the next one, which is the high security versus high action, is you need to be careful with the cinematic flair. Because then you have to, as a reading the classified RPG, which is a serial numbers filed off clone of the James Bond RPG, is that you need, if your players are going to be these high action agents, they know that they have, you know, a heads up on everyone else in the field. So you have to kind of change the stakes, not necessarily to them, but to other people or other interests of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So threatening to hurt them isn't such a big deal as it is to say they might destroy a civilian, that the bad guys might destroy a civilian target that is of concern to the agents.
Oh, absolutely. Like, what if Mr. Evil, for all intents and purposes, has his lair on the middle of the back 40? How secure should it be?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you could go cartoony, or you could go very simple and you just have a bunch of dogs. Or you could go for cameras or something to that effect here, because maybe you could do it almost like a militia group, for example, of this organization. You know?
Yes.
A little bit of doomsday preppers, and then how do you handle that unless you're like James Bond? Or then you start crossing that line between military and a more kind of civilian spy type craft.
Yep.
Comes to stuff like that there. Yeah. Also, it really sucks if they actually do security properly, because you're basically going to be doing, you know, I think it's safe to assume everybody here has done a good old-fashioned dungeon hack where you have to clean by 10x10 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the modern equivalent, because you'd be looking for bugs all the friggin' time, or cameras and setting stuff up. Well, you should have elements of that, because that's part of the game. And of course, you got to get past the defenses. You got to make sure it doesn't become tedious, otherwise you're going to be bored out of your skull.
True.
All right, let's go to the high-tech versus sci-fi one that you got listed here.
Yeah. Basically, the question is, how much grounded in reality do you want the technology? Now, realize we're living in 2017 where we have little computers that we carry in our phones. That really does change the nature of how you do the things here. But if you watch the old James Bond movies, some of their inventions were utterly ludicrous for the time.
And actually, in modern times, you realize they're even more ludicrous because they're still not feasible.
Absolutely. Right. Like the magnetic bullet deflector watch.
Yeah.
Live and Let Die and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's how plausible do you want the technology we're using? Or if you go into some of the crazy stuff that was done, like the men who stare at goats, everybody's psyched.
Right. Yep.
You know, well, that'll totally change the campaign for tradecraft, because it's hard to lie to a psyker unless you have some sort of preparation or countermeasure for it.
Well, you know, and I mean, in some ways, that's where Agent of Oblivion kind of sits in that area, you know, where it's kind of more sci-fi-ish span, you know, sci-fi spy game.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you could RPG, obviously, the X-Files or some other scenarios, or even Men in Black, I think, with that one.
Okay.
So
I can see that.
But it is a tough one, you know, like how much science fiction do you want in your game? And it's like, I mean, you could even argue that how much technology do you want in your game?
Yeah, that's probably a big one too.
You know, I mean, but, and then it's funny, because then if you actually look at what actually happened in terms of spycraft in the real world, some of that stuff that actually existed, you're just like, that's crazy.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, you know, some of the reliability on some of their equipment was insanely bad. But you're just like weird one-shot pistols, you know, cameras and all sorts of weird, hidden cameras and,
You know, like, hell, the Penguin from friggin' Batman, all his umbrellas, some of them were actually made in the real world, which is even more insane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So when you look at that, you know, radios in a variety of methods, and nowadays radios are so freaking tiny, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
And of course, with the current technology that we have today, you know, who needs, you know, as long as you have some sort of some secure method of communication, yeah, you know that there's somebody with a, you know, I don't know. I mean, you're talking, you know, via the internet, can you have secure communications? Oddly, yes, contrary to popular belief. That said, it's not impossible, but it's just, it's not easy on either end user.
Right.
At the, you know, I mean, there's a certain technical expectation, you know. That's one of the reasons that encryption, which probably should be standard for almost everyone, isn't highly used, because it's still not at the point where it's like a default for everybody. And none of the governments want it like that either anyway, which is why that won't happen.
Yeah. Fortunately, there's a grain of truth to that. And also, you kind of want to have, for your plot line, for your trade craft, that's a good way to start a premise. We intercepted this email. We're worried about it. It's coming from this place. Can you go check it out, please?
Right.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have your plot hook to set things up.
Well, you know, I think even in a high-tech world, the more I think about it, the more the ground roots, trade spycraft stuff, actually becomes more and more useful in many ways. Because, yeah, you can track, you have to track the person. Like, you know, the old dead drop system that probably is still used today in some modified form. It's like,
and money still talks.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's that. Frequently, the way in is going to be through a person.
Yeah. You know. So I mean, I guess I think the thing about any spy game, and I think this is the same thing with like mysteries or police style games or whatever the hell you want to run like that. You have, or in like even like a mysteries, you have to have a good solid idea about how things work. Otherwise, you're never going to be answer the player's questions, and the adventures are going to suck. And I think in a spy game, it's very important to know, well, this guy does this. You know, it's like, I think sometimes the amount of information you need for every person in a spy game is more than, like, where, you know, in a fantasy game, you almost don't care. Unless, of course, you're running a fantasy spy game, and that actually makes things even more interesting.
Well, then you get the court intrigue, which is actually where...
Well, not only that, but you could possibly have magic in the mix, too, which changes things.
Yeah, and that's actually a problem, because it's hard to have a real espionage game without proper countermeasures in place when somebody can just detect alignment or detect evil.
Well, you know, but it's funny. You know,
yes.
Rolemaster, God bless them, actually had a character class that was a semi-spell user specifically for that stuff.
Okay, I can see that.
Where they had spell lists that included things like create evidence.
Okay, that's awesome.
And, you know, like, you know, one of the things was study Patsy. So you would actually cast a spell to gain information about a person so that you could actually use them as a template for your other spells, like create evidence, or, and even had spells that went all the way to the edge of where it would actually mess with divinations.
Required for any spy in a,
right. So, like, let's say this guy was sent to kill, you know, some king, and you know, the only thing that the people with the crystal balls could see is just, you know, some shadowy figure shooting an arrow. They can't see the actual figure because he's masked by that. And it's like, wow, that makes a lot of effing sense.
Well, I think also in a fantasy game, you have, you know, you mentioned some of the spells that detect lies, detect evil. You can't cast that on everyone. And if you are an opposition in a fantasy world, you would realize, hey, I need to send at least 3 or 4 assassins, assuming that 2 or 3 of them are probably going to get caught. What I need to do is get numbers in there because, you know, eventually their spellcasters are going to run out of juice or spell points or whatever. You know, you're not going to just send in one guy and have him get caught at the gate. Like, are you an assassin? No. You know, your tactics are going to be different because you know that these things exist.
Yeah, you might almost have to set up a cell system because you don't want everybody to know just a little, just enough that they, if they get in trouble, they're not going to break your plan.
Right. Right.
You know, because that way they would detect thoughts. Oh, look, he knows only this. Yep. It's enough to get him incriminated, not much else, to actually determine who it is. You'd almost have to put wheels within the wheels to set it up properly. Plus, I remember this really cool item from the old Akadim 2nd edition, where when you died while wearing it, you could not speak with dead to the guy, which is another problem with Medic spell. You know, you kill the guy, you speak with dead, you make him tell you whatever the hell he's going to tell you in the first place, and bingo, murder mystery relatively solved quickly. So it's kind of good that there was a countermeasure already thought up in that case.
Yeah. All right, why don't we get to... Let's just go with props, because that's we kind of talked about that a little bit earlier with the Kickstarter.
Yep.
And then after that, we need to move on.
Okay, fair enough. Well, but we already talked about how we like our dossiers and papers and tapestries and stuff. Ultimately, unlike, you know, I guess you could almost try to set it up almost like an office space in a lot of ways. You're doing it in ways. Like, you kind of want the white, you know, the black and white, the very sterilized environment if you're going to try to set up a spy game. You know, at least for the first part, if you're more of an operative or an intel guy, as opposed to... Or then, again, if you're trying to do more of like living high on the hog in the Riviera, hanging out and being kind of a pseudo-celebrity while doing your job, I can see a totally different feel for the game.
I think one of the things that'd be handy for props... Well, one of the things necessary, I think, at a minimum, even if you don't do the dossier, are maps.
Yes.
I think those are really key, since a lot of your spy stuff is going to be set pieces. You're going to have chases, but there are going to be set pieces too that are frequently going to come up, and I think maps are pretty much vital to that, so that everybody has an idea of what you're looking at. I mean, in fantasy, you encounter a troll in the woods, it's not a big deal. And even in necessarily in a dungeon room, you can sketch that out, but when you have a half a dozen outbuildings and a main... a main building and maybe a satellite dish park, you need to know where those are, especially if you're sending explosives, looking for cover, looking for the
any number,
you know, the garage.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, one of my things that I always do, I mean, this applies to spy games, science fiction games. I mean, I've bought off of DriveThruRPG a lot is just maps, you know, maps of locations, like, oh, I need some modern buildings. It's like, oh, this is a small restaurant. This is, you know, because you don't know. You know, sometimes you don't know. Or like mm-hmm. you said, like I actually have like some sort of mansion house. And I've used that several times in several different adventures just because it's done. It's like I don't have to design another mansion house. I can kind of use that one every once in a while and no one cares. It's like, oh, and it's a nice mansion house. It has a nice living room. It has like this little library, which is on two stories. It has like... You know, like a secret passageway, actually. I think this one did, from the upstairs to the downstairs. And, you know, I've used it several times. And it's great because, you know, then you have people, you know, it's like I even have it printed out. I've actually printed out and taped all the sheets together and just laid it on the table. It's like, I don't care if the players know because it's too confusing anyway. It's a modern mm-hmm. building, you know. Who cares if they actually even know the layout? It almost doesn't help them.
Yeah. And actually, in a weird way, Gary Gygax's words might become a little prophetic. It'd almost be a good idea to have some sort of timetable, you know, when you're trying to set up your spy thing.
Oh, like, no, you absolutely do.
This is going to happen. If you don't stop this, like, basically you have one flow chart saying what happens if the players don't get involved. And that gives you an idea what sort of accurate measurement of what occurs, because you need to be in East Berlin on this day, at this hour, at this hotel.
No, you absolutely do. I think there's a lot of games that if it's not a fantasy game, you kind of do need timetables, and people don't realize it. You know, mm-hmm. if it's not something that's going to be just basically a dungeon crawl, you kind of need timetables for the adventure. Because, again, at the very least, you need to know certain key NPCs' movements and where they go, what they're going to do on certain days. Because, you know, let's face it, let's say you realize that this is the day of the event and the players have something staked out, and it's like, the NPC's never going to be there. They're assuming they, you know, maybe they don't know when the day is, but they just happen to pick the day to monitor that location. And why didn't he show up? Because he was off, you know, I don't know, you know, stealing the crown jewels.
he was off in Kyoto at a business meeting when, you know, they thought he should be in Berlin.
Right.
You know, making a deal with a drug runner. I mean, arms runner. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So. All right. Any closing comments?
Well, I'm going to recommend the game that I actually is my favorite for this sort of spy type campaigns. It's kind of heavy in vampires, but I think it's safe to assume that I'm a diehard fan of Knights Black Agents, because it's basically essentially operatives versus vampires, where you basically have to collect the dirt and so forth. And they actually have these charts where the actions of the PCs affect what the vampire does, kind of a positive effect thing. And it easily could be translated to a more conventional game without too many problems. Especially if you're trying to do an old Cold War movie or something.
Yeah.
My recommendation would definitely be the James Bond RPG / Classified. I really love the it's a unified dice system, and it has a graded system where the better you roll on your initial skill check, the better your damage or your effect. I really thought that was always elegant since I first saw it, and I still think it's a really neat system.
I would have to say, if I had to make a recommendation, maybe Agents of Oblivion, if you wanted some more fantastical elements, maybe some pulpy elements into your spy game. And as much as I hate to admit it, I would probably have people stay away from Spycraft as a game. As much as, you know, I like the idea of Spycraft, I love it's a, you know, it's kind of a D20 based system, but I think for a lot of people it's too much of a fire hose to grasp.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I think it might bog down what any spy game should have, that kind of sense of impending action. Even if you are analysts who've just been crammed out into the field because you're the only people available, you still need that sense of impending action. If you've got a massive rule set hanging over your head.
Yeah. That said, really I like the idea of Spycraft over like D20 Modern, because I like the character classes in Spycraft over D20 Modern. D20 Modern is like the smart hero, the strong hero.
Yeah.
Really? Right. Those are classes? Those are more ideas, not early classes. That's what bothered me about D20 Modern. You know.
Well, I get what you're trying to do, but it didn't play.
They sounded lame, and I looked down like, no, I'm going to do Spycraft instead. And not that Spycraft is bad, but it is very complex. The rules do bog down. The feat trees are huge.
Okay. Mm.
So that's one of the reasons I almost can't recommend them, because it's not a streamlined process. And then, of course, I don't think any of the players really understood the equipment behind concept, the way they did the equipment picks, and then of course you never seem to get enough equipment, and you always have one player who, you know, it's like somebody usually had to take the feat bag full of guns just so that everyone had a gun. It's just like, because, you know, I mean, some players they don't have enough resources to actually get enough equipment picks to even get a gun.
Yeah.
So
it's
just one of those things. All right, so why don't we switch gears, and we're going to talk about sports and gaming. And I know some of you guys are going to come out. One is actual sports and RPGs. One of them is actual RPGs that are sports. And then I was going to take it. I like the concept of taking it kind of from the setting of sports in the setting itself.
Okay, I can see that.
Interesting.
Well, because I remember someone mentioning a few in one of the emails, and I'm like, in a setting, there's a lot of historical examples you can draw inspiration from.
Absolutely. And part of the fun is taking a sport in our world, just tweaking a little bit. Like, one of my personal favorites, and the one I basically want to start the conversation with, is, of course, Blood Bowl. Or the most violent football game ever.
Yep.
You know, you got your... It's basically fantasy football, quite literally, because half the races are not human.
Right.
And body count is through the yin yang. But because, you know, it's almost more or less an RPG and more of a tabletop game. But if you've ever played it once, it's fun to play. I ain't gonna lie to you.
Yep.
You know, and of course you can throw in stuff like Auto Duel or Car Wars.
Well, yeah, Car Wars is probably, I mean, at least from if you consider car driving and shooting people a sport, yeah.
Well, the original ones, according to the history, were set up
as a sport.
You know, as arena duels between just like demolition derbies, and then someone mounted some 50 caliber machine guns on their car and had a distinct advantage in their next match.
Yeah. And if you ever, like, I collected all the old Car Wars stuff, and Man, they were creative with their arenas. You had some that basically filled up with lava. You had some that basically were on spinning wheels and so forth. I'm not sure how well they would actually play in the game itself, but darn it, the creativity was through the roof.
Yeah, now Car Wars has a special place in my heart, and you know, I actually have some of the old Car Wars stuff myself. I have like some of the old Car Wars actual street tiles. They were like thick laminated, semi-laminate cardboard that you had to cut out, and you have the road sections.
Yeah, I remember those
that you could put together.
I have some of them,
and those are fantastic. You know, I mean, I have a shitload of counters still. I have all the old little counters because I never lost any of them. What was it?
All the ones you had to cut out by hand.
Yep. You know,
with scissors. Yeah,
with scissors. And I have them in these, and I have them in these trays and Ziploc bags, and you know, I mean, Car Wars was a fun game, and yeah, that's just, I mean, and it's funny because it did eventually spawn an RPG, but it was really originally more just a car-on-car duel where the characters were the cars, not really the people in them, per se. Although, it was weird because you could have drivers that had advancement.
Yes.
To a limited extent. So that was always cool.
And of course, that was brought up by our associates here, you guys could always talk about something like X-Crawl, where you take the typical fantasy dungeon hack and you basically make it a sports game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give them full kudos and credit for that. I picked up the books, and they're a lot of fun, and it's kind of neat just seeing what the stuff is.
Is that a futuristic setting, or is that actually still a fantasy setting?
It's still a fantasy campaign, you know, setting with a bit of tweaks there.
Okay.
I actually was at one of my first local gaming stores. They actually ran a tournament in X-Crawl, and I kind of broke the game with a simple first-level spell map. Because they weren't sure how to tally up the fact that I brought a horse to the game.
Hmm.
It was kind of fun.
Hmm. Okay.
Because the first level spell creates basically just a generic riding horse, which gives you a lot of advantages in a dungeon hack because you can actually move faster than everybody else. You can use it for cover. You can even have a better attack than your typical character because he's got a better attack bonus. And it was kind of mind-blowing how such a simple spell kind of changed the nature of the game.
Well,
and, you know, and it's a lot of fun. And you had sponsors and so forth, and it was actually a lot of fun just sort of playing that stuff. Anybody else play?
I don't think I've ever played that. No.
Nope, I have not played that one.
Okay. Well, it's fun, but you got to make sure you have the right group, and they make sure that they actually want to play it almost like a franchise. So you take your adventuring party, and you basically play Smash TV in the game. And I love Smash TV. It's actually one of my favorite games from that era. And it's fun just seeing how it's played in more of a fantasy method.
Okay.
Smash. Smash TV, was that a video game?
Yes, it was. It was actually a stand-up arcade game.
Yeah.
Yeah. You had two joysticks, one for moving and one for firing. And basically, it was a bullet. Yeah.
I know. I was about to say, because I know I played that before. That was such a weird game.
Big money, big prizes.
See, I used to live in the video arcade when I was a child. Yeah.
Good place to live.
You also have your gladiatorial arenas, which are some of your oldest formalized games, I'm guessing, from, you know, that you'd be able to use in a RPG, I think.
Oh, well, hell, I mean, if you take it from just games, I mean, you had RuneQuest had Monster Colosseum supplement, which was basically gladiatorial combat, but included, obviously, some of the more fantastical elements.
Hmm.
It was published under Avalon Hill. I only know because I own it.
Yeah, and again, like Scourge of the Slave Lords had it. You know, basically you were slaves and you basically got thrown in an arena, or Dark Sun, which definitely plays up the arena aspect there, especially in the town.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you see, this kind of dovetails to what I was talking about, where, you know, there's a lot of games and settings, per se, that, you know, the RPGs themselves don't talk about games, but the setting could have games, and especially when you get to, like I said, the historical elements. Historical inspiration. There are tons of them. I mean, you know, I mean, let's face it. You take just simple. You take the early Greek Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, hey, let's have Olympics instead of wars. Okay, you know, that could be an interesting RPG element. You know, someone has some sort of Olympia.
Your Arthurian knightly tournaments.
Yeah. Well, jousting in general. You know, you could have joust tournaments.
Jousting.
You know, and I mean, it's not just even jousting. I mean, you take just even simple, like, you know, hell, let's just go to the Roman era, and you have the gladiatorial combats, and that's a social event, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's very important to the society as a whole, whether or not you agree with people fighting, and people fighting not always to the death, but sometimes to the death, you know, or the blood and gore. You can argue that one way or the other.
Yep.
You know, so you have that. You have the gladiatorial combat. You have the jousting. And if you just, hey, you know what? You take it to the Americas, early Americas. You know, and I don't think we actually know how the game was actually played. But, and we don't really know what was actually played. We just call them ball courts.
Right.
You know, if you look in, you know, obviously South America and, you know, Central America and stuff, even into the Americas, North America itself, there are these things that were called ball courts. And we kind of suspect that, you know, like, I think in some societies they would play these ball games, and, you know, the losers wouldn't necessarily live, nor would the winners. but it was, you know, it was all a matter of society. And, you know, if you portray that in could you imagine playing that, you know, having either forcing the players to play in it, or let's say they visit a society where they play such a game, you know, the moral choices they may have to choose, or, you know, because who knows what the adventure might be. The adventure might be, hey, you know what, one of the people that's chosen to play on one of the teams that may live or die depending on the success of the game, you know, you need for some either piece of information, or maybe you need them to, maybe you were sent to rescue them for some reason. You know, how do you do that? Well, you know, a variety of ways. I mean, they're just adventure ideas off the top of your head.
Yep.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, once you talk about Gladiator, you got to talk about ancient Rome and all the associated chicanery that could happen because of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, you might, you know, you could easily make a game where you're basically trying to provide acts for the Colosseum.
Oh, yeah.
Like going out and, you know, doing whatever to get the shows or the next big show. Or, if you want to go for a totally different path, one of my favorite books is actually based from the 70s, called Damnation Decade, where they do kind of a pseudo-apocalyptic 70s type feel, and they created their own sport called a Mega Ball.
Of course they did.
Of course they did, because, you know, that was that era. You know, they had all these...
Oh, hell! I mean, just hell, if you want... it's not an RPG, but if you want inspiration for a society game, you gotta go with the old James Caan Rollerball.
That's what you were basically inspired from, for sure. And, of course, it's basically a cross between football and lacrosse, where you basically beat the crap out of each other because, you know, it's blood sports. And blood sports, 9 times out of 10, are what happens with sports and gaming. You know, you don't come out... The only reason why you can come out relatively intact is because we use hit points and not body parts.
Mm.
So, that could be fun. And
unless you have a game system that has critical hits.
Oh, good lord, yeah. But I was playing a lot, actually. And again, you could easily reinterpret that. Like last time we talked about the Running Man. That's easily convertible into like a post-apocalyptic or dystopian type thing.
Definitely true. Dystopian. Yeah. I could see something like that in like a Shadowrun or even a cyberpunk type game.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
You know.
And I could see that as well. Or you could take an interpretation of a sport. Like it's kind of stupid and kind of fun at the same time. Now, one of the most popular fictional sports involves brooms.
Yeah,
I'm talking about.
I mean, it's a great idea, but it's such an awful game. It's really a terrible game, in terms of rules. There's absolutely no point to playing for either side except for the two people who are trying to catch the snitch.
Yeah, well, the problem is I could get the pointing, but as soon as the snitch becomes, whoever catches the snitch wins the game.
Yeah,
nobody else needs to be there.
Exactly.
You know, it's not a team sport anymore.
Exactly. There's no point in either side playing until it's determined that one side can't catch the snitch. The snitch is...
Anyway. It should eliminate completely from the game if they want to make it more plausible.
Yes.
But it also can take a real cultural element there when you take like a race. What if you want to reinterpret, basically a sport often reflects a culture of a people. And then when you add racial traits on top of that, it actually has a lot more interesting. Like, I'm going to have a product out next week where I created a sport called Worm Smacker, which could be best described as what happens when Minotaurs play full contact cricket. It's going to be a blast. Like, a buddy of mine was so inspired by it, he actually wrote a free pamphlet that's going to be coming out at the same time as the book. just to show how this board actually works page for page and how you resolve it using game mechanics. So I guess that's ultimately, and then you could do something like that with orcs or elves or dwarves. How do they compete and why do they compete? It could be just as important for plot hooks.
Or even how do they compete? Like let's take something that, well, let's take a couple of things that is oddly, not necessarily, some people would not necessarily consider it a sport, but might be a sport. And I mean, you might as well just say, instead of sport, you might just put the word game in sometimes.
Yeah, true.
Because, you know, let's face it, what's on some of the sports channels? Something that I wouldn't consider a sport.
Poker is one.
Poker.
Is a big one.
Poker.
No.
I mean, I'm not saying that chess is, but something like chess could possibly be for a society, especially one that's more intellectual. I mean, I'm sure there's something like with the Vulcans. I mean, if you had Vulcans in a society, they wouldn't. I mean, they might actually do some sort of weird blood sports. You never know. But I'm just saying they might actually have some sort of intellectual thing, games that are basically more like sports to them.
Yep.
Or yep. I mean, hell, I mean, you even go to anything that anyone bets on is in some ways is considered a sport.
Yeah,
true.
You know, and actually, that's an interesting aspect to any type of, when we talk about sports in any RPG, is the fact that, you know, if it's a sport, someone's going to bet on it, and there springs endless possibilities of adventures ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, I forget what the hell, there's a Talos Lanta, which was originally published by Bard Games, and then by WotC, and then by a whole bunch of other people. I think they're in the 4th or 5th edition now, I think. Mm-hmm. One of the races in Talos Lanta, because there were tons of them, had some sort of weird game where they would like drop like balls into this thing and it would change colors and do things, and only the people of that race even understood how to play the game because they had two brains and you needed two brains to actually understand how to play.
Dang.
Yeah,
interesting.
But it didn't stop people from betting on who the winner would be.
Nice.
You know.
And again, that's a whole new chicanery there because everybody's going to want to hedge and so forth. Like, there's this really awesome movie that MST3K did back before they got transferred over to the Comedy Channel that was called Superdome, where it actually kind of mixes with the Spycraft show because they basically do, it's a spy movie based around the big game. And a lot of them basically trying to hedge the bets, see if they can maximize their money. People get kidnapped, you know. It's your typical 70s shenanigans when it comes to that sort of thing. Because, of course, the big game is sacred in that sort of element there. And this is all the almost covert stuff that happens because of it.
No, I mean, but that's what I'm talking about. There's so many adventure ideas when you include these things as a possible something in the setting, you know, of a game. You know, whether it be science fiction, fantasy, you name it. You know, you have all this. You're right. You know, you have a lot of spy elements. I mean, heck, even in the modern day. You know, could you imagine? I mean, you have, you know, because espionage isn't just between countries; it's between corporations.
Yep.
You know, especially when you include corporate espionage, that just ups the ante. And who knows? Maybe, I mean, hell, I mean, you take something like, I'm not saying that it ever has happened, but you take something like, you know, obviously something like, what's the big soccer event or football as everyone else in the world? Is it the World Cup?
Yeah, the World Cup.
You take an event like a World Cup where, you know, national prestige is in play here.
Actually, that'd be kind of a fun tradecraft campaign.
Exactly. I've been thinking the entire thing.
For being caught taking drugs because it'll be a national embarrassment.
Or heaven forbid, maybe you're sent to capture some you know, kidnap relatives of one of the opposing team's players, or who knows what.
Absolutely. You know,
not that I'm condoning any of that. I'm just saying for an adventure, it'd be an interesting idea.
Simply for a fictional experience.
Or maybe you're sent to rescue somebody whose family member has been captured.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
You know. There's all kinds of spins. And I mean, I think that's the thing that we forget when we game. Sometimes there's all these interesting elements. You know, I do. I know I forget all the time. What am I doing in an adventure? Yeah. It's like when I talk to you guys, sometimes I'm like, I've come up with ideas that I've never used. Why the hell haven't I done that?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And
what if?
And it's just, so it's mind-boggling that, you know, we do forget about these things. We forget about all the cultural elements of a society that we're pretending to play in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think that's a mistake.
Oh, not the screen there. Oh, and I got a crazy one. what if you involve the mascot as part of the actual spy thing? What if you steal the goat or whatever is their mascot?
That sounds like a low-level spy game at a college.
Exactly. Kind of like a first leveler.
Yeah. Oh my god, actually that would be a fun for a one shot.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, you all members of some weird fraternity, and it's like your idea, your mission is to go capture the mascot of the opposing team and keep it safe for an evening.
Or if you were actual agents and then ordered to go find the mascot, you'd be like, why are we rescuing a goat?
Or anything like that. I'm just saying.
And then you find out that there's some kind of major league corruption within the college sports franchise that they're trying to capture, and the goat has something to do with that. Yeah.
It's like microfilm along the collar. It has it hidden from like...
Exactly.
Or any number of things. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know. Maybe the mascot was actually, you know, over the... of one of the teams was actually one of your guys' agents. That was just his cover.
Oh, good Lord. Now we're going to full Get Smart territory, like Agent Rex.
I'm just saying, though. I mean,
it's awesome, man. I like that.
But there's just so many things that you could do. And I mean, you know, I think this is what I think this is one of the things that we need, you know, would be fun to organize sometime is, like, for game masters who want to make adventures, have a brainstorming session with just a whole bunch of other people.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to throw out ideas and everyone, you know, because everyone's going to walk away with ideas for an adventure.
Yep.
Because I think that's one of the things that when you're by yourself, you don't have enough people to bounce things off of as a game master.
Oh, agree.
Because who are you going to talk to? The people you play with? You don't want to give them, as weird as it sounds, I know it's not game master versus players, but you don't want to ruin the adventure for them by talking to them about it. Maybe afterwards you can. But, I think it's almost like you need a game master support group that you can go and talk to people at.
Oh, I agree completely here. I got a couple of buddies of mine who aren't involved in my games, but I sure love throwing ideas off them.
You need that, I think.
Oh, agreed.
So, all right, anything else we need to talk about? Because we're probably should cut this pretty close here.
Okay, I'm just going to have a quick announcement here. On the 31st of January, I'll be releasing my product, The Minotaurs of the Stone Land. It's for Forgotten Realms and the GM's Guild. Basically, it's my interpretation of Minotaurs within Forgotten Realms. And long story short, they ultimately ended up in Scottish Minotaurs. So I think you guys will have fun if you read it.
That's on the DM's Guild then?
Yeah, it'll be on the GM's Guild. Okay. On the 31st, it'll be released.
And this is for just 5e, or is it also for Pathfinder?
It's for 5e, you know. That's what they're allowed to do there. So basically, I went wild and came out in about 43 pages. Plus, added a couple adventures. Like one of the adventures is actually at the back is a dungeon hack of your own home. And I always thought that'd be kind of a neat thing experience. You basically go in the middle of things, and you basically come home to your settlement, and everybody's missing. So now what do you do?
Okay.
You know, because you normally murder hobos go in there, they kill everything, they steal everything. But because there will actually be real-time percussions if you steal everything here, or possibly tribal things if you manage to get everybody back, it causes a lot of people to do a double take and so forth. You know, you could steal the cows, but then your people will starve, and that kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, or if you run off with that relic from atop the bar, they're going to know when you have that come back.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I just love concepts like that. But that's pretty much my announcements.
Okay. All right. My announcement is I actually might actually get to my one of my gaming resolutions for this year.
Oh, which is that?
Face-to-face gaming.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of some talks with some people that I know, and we all kind of want to do some face-to-face gaming, so we're actually sorting that out. So hopefully here in a couple of weeks, you know, at least within the next month, we should start some face-to-face gaming sessions. Someone's actually volunteered to run, so I don't have to run, so I'll actually get to play for a change.
Hooray! That's awesome.
5th edition.
Okay.
Not my first choice, but you know what? I'm not running.
Yeah, if you're not running, you have a lot of tolerance.
So that's good news. Second is that... I haven't figured out how I'm going to do it, but I got another one of those stupid iTunes $25 gift cards that I will never use. So I'm trying to figure out a good way to give that out to one of our listeners. I don't know how I'm going to do that yet, but I want to. That's something that's on the books.
Okay. I got a stipulation. They have to be a guest here, and they have to bring a topic.
Well, I don't. We'll see. I'm just trying to figure that out. How we're going to arrange that? Because I don't want, you know, I'm honest. I don't want to make it sound like, oh well, the only way you're going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll make it. We'll figure out some sort of hockey contest to be entertaining.
So that said, if you have anything you want to send us a comment on, you can do it either by sending us an email, info@rpgcircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page or Google Plus page, post something there. On our website or on our Facebook, there's a link to the voicemail application. You go there, you can send us a voicemail because we haven't got any audio comments in a long time. I really wish somebody would send us one. Even if it's telling me that I suck, I'll go ahead and play that. I don't care. Nice. Anything else?
Not for me.
All right, then we're going to go ahead and exit on a good note. And, you know, these things have been running about an hour and a half, and I kind of wonder if everyone likes that as a time length, if they want it shorter or longer.
Let us know.
Yeah, let us know.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.